Hey everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and with me tonight is a special guest because she's visiting all the way from Melbourne, Australia. I am here with Katie Mack. You may know her on the Twits as @AstroKatie. She is an astrophysicist who is working on her postdoc at Melbourne University. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm so excited. So you may know, if you're following me on Twitter at all, that I had a bunch of people over at my house this evening to do a fun party and watch Cosmos and eat food. And Katie was here with, I think it was something like 13 other people. Our friend Allie took a funny selfie of everybody. Somehow we all fit in the same picture.
It was so much better than Ellen's.
Yeah, I think so too. And Killer, my dog, like photobombed it, which was good. So we all were watching Cosmos, and this has become a regular thing for us. I think we're on episode 4 now.
We just watched episode 3, I think.
Oh, yeah, okay. So the next one's 4. Like, I have no idea. And it was, I feel like it's getting to be more compelling because we're talking about more kind of big picture universal stuff. But there were some concepts that were discussed in the episode that, I mean, for some people, this is not new stuff, you know, but for some people, they've never even heard of some of these concepts before. So, Neil was getting into the idea of the speed of light, and he was talking a little bit about black holes, and there were a lot of interesting comparisons that were made. And it was pretty cool because we had a room full of scientists, non-scientists, science communicators, a lot of people that come, to be honest, in this room, I think, were a lot of people that come from the biological sciences.
Yeah.
So you were sort of our token answer every question anybody had physicist in the room. So I want to start maybe with some of that, and then we'll start talking a little bit about the research that you do.
Okay.
Some of the big questions that were asked, well, one thing that kind of weirded me out was that Neil was talking about black holes, and he said, what if going into a black hole leads to another universe? Yeah. And I thought to myself, like, I've never heard a physicist say that. Maybe somebody out there thinks that that's a viable kind of hypothesis, but is that common?
Well, so that whole idea comes up a lot in sort of popular science kind of stuff. But in terms of what theoretical physicists talk about when we talk about black holes, or when astrophysicists talk about black holes, it's the black hole is really never a wormhole. So the idea is that a black hole is a kind of pinching of space-time. It's like making this sort of super curved sort of point in space-time. And you can imagine that kind of point, like, sort of then widens out into a funnel somewhere else, and you have a like wormhole kind of structure, and you wouldn't be able to see if that happened if you were sort of on the outside, because everything would look like it fell right in. And so in theory, you can use kind of similar shapes of space-time to get a wormhole out of something that's a black hole, but in terms of like what you'd see from the outside. But you would never survive getting through anyway, and there's nothing to keep a wormhole from pinching off into two black holes, even if you had a wormhole that was,
sure,
like connecting two points of space-time. So you can imagine it kind of like you know those little finger puzzle things that you stick your fingers in, and you try and pull your finger out, and it like squeezes in the middle. I don't know if you can imagine this.
I'm doing
hand motions, but so a wormhole would be sort of like that kind of shape, but another like dimension up, and it would connect two different points in space-time. But there's nothing to keep it from just pinching off in the center. So you'd have to have something to like
keep it open?
To keep it open, yeah, which doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I don't think Donnie Darko was a documentary. Like, I think that's the consensus here. And you know what's funny is I always kind of thought that when you look at those artistic renderings of a black hole, like maybe in a textbook or in a popular science TV show, and they show kind of space in two dimensions, and then they show the black hole dropping down into the third dimension, kind of making that funnel.
Yeah.
I always thought that was kind of supposed to be taken as, if we lived in two dimensions, here's how it happens in the third. But since we live in three dimensions, like, I guess I never thought there actually was a funneling of space. I thought it kind of looked the same from the top as it would from the bottom, as it does from the side. Yeah, like that a black hole from all angles is sucking down just into one super gravitational dense core.
Yeah, it's the whole thing, it's spherically symmetric. Unless it's spinning, then you get some kind of weird non-symmetries. But it's basically a spherically symmetric thing. So any direction you look at a black hole from, it would look the same. Unless it has stuff falling into it along a disk, but that's a kind of different topic. So you can, like, this whole funnel thing is just a sort of visualization in a 2D version of something that's another dimension higher up. And it's really a nice way to describe it, because we can intuitively think about things falling into a, like, you know, a vortex or something like that, like down a drain. And it's the same, it's a similar kind of physics, you know, you sort of circle the drain and you fall in, and we get that intuitively. And so we can kind of get intuitively the idea that there's this like hole is sort of funnel shape and it pinches to a point, and that's kind of like space-time curving a lot and pinching to a point. And we do talk about space-time curvature. And when we draw that, we usually draw it as, you know, that kind of curve, but really it's, space-time curvature is really all about what happens to two parallel like light beams, like would they come together? And so if you have a very curved space-time, then two parallel beams of light would intersect. And so it's like everything's being drawn together, but that would happen in all directions the same way. So
no matter where you were looking, if you were looking up, down, left, right, from that point where space-time was curving toward, it wouldn't matter. Those parallel lines would do the same thing.
Yeah.
And that, actually, the interesting thing is that reminds me, and I'm sure everybody's like, stop, rewind, I've got to envision this a little bit more. These are the kinds of conversations that really can start to blow your mind, especially when you don't have visuals in front of you and you have to kind of create your own visuals in your head, which I'm going to back up a second. I remember when I worked at the Huffington Post and I did Talk Nerdy to Me, my video series, I interviewed Neil for one of them, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is now hosting the Cosmos reboot. And I interviewed Brian Greene for one of them. He's a very well-known theoretical physicist, but popular science communicator at this point too. And I asked them both the same question, which was, do you have some sort of perceptual skill that I am lacking? Can you think in more than three dimensions? And I always think it's funny to get physicists' responses of that. So I'll ask you what you think first. I'll tell you what they told me, but I'll ask you what your answer to that is first. Do you have some sort of ability to think or see in those ways that just kind of your everyday man is lacking?
No. I think the difference the way I think about it is I translate that into sort of the mathematics of that. And I can think about how that mathematics works, but I can't visualize it as like objects in, I mean, you know, it's funny. Sometimes I do try to think about four dimensional space time as in three dimensions of space and one of time. Mm-hmm. So like you've seen like, light sculptures where people like move a flashlight around and do a long exposure. That kind of art, that kind of imagery is kind of like a space-time painting.
That's so smart because it's really temporal. Like it goes away after you perceive it.
Yeah. And so like that, that kind of space-time, that kind of like light painting where you see the trail where the thing was and you see it kind of building up an object. That's sort of like building something in fourth dimensional space-time. Like you're stretching it out through 3D space and, you know, including that time element. And you kind of, so I kind of try every once in a while, I think about that. Like if I'm crossing a street, I think of like the cars forming these long tubes of, you know, these sort of ultra stretch limousines as sort of the space time equivalent of a car going by. It's a weird visualization thing that I think comes from thinking about special relativity too much. But, you know, I mean, but in general, like, no, I can't picture like a fourth dimensional hypercube, in my head. Like,
yeah,
I just,
that's,
you know,
what, you know, that's what Brian actually told me. He's like, okay, no, of course not. Like, physicists don't have the skills. We think in math, and sometimes that allows us to talk about these things, but we come up with analogies just like anybody else. He had a lot of analogies, I think, in oh gosh, I don't remember which book he opens up talking about being a kid and standing in between two mirrors and looking at these kind of infinite reflections going back and forth and really thinking, and he would move his arms and his arms would ripple down. And that really was some sort of weird analogy that he worked into his understanding of space-time, of that fourth dimension. Of course, when I asked Neil, he told me that, of course, there's a fourth dimension club and I'm not invited. So that's kind of rough. But we were talking about this idea of things being sort of equidistant, or if you're in the middle of a black hole and you're looking from all different angles, that it's sort of that concept of, I guess, singularity is not really the right term, but that concept of a one thing that's collapsing on itself and up, down, left, right doesn't really matter. It reminds me of a question that one of our friends was asking about light and about the speed of light and about the expansion of the universe, and how she was saying, but if you're in one part of the universe, couldn't you look in one direction and see some of our historical timeline, and it would be maybe more time had passed if I look left than if I look right? And we were all trying to kind of understand this concept of space, no matter where you are physically in the universe, even though there was one singular big bang, space goes on in all directions for just the same distance.
Yeah, so the singular big bang thing is I think something that is people get easily sort of misled by that picture, thinking about it in terms of an explosion from a single point out in all directions. And it's not the way we think about the Big Bang. It's not really like that. So we think about the Big Bang in terms of, in the past, things that are far apart now are more closer together. And if you sort of extend that back logically, then things that are really far apart now, we're all in the same spot. But that kind of collapse, it's, if you think about it that way, it's not really to a single point in one part of space. It's kind of all of space is collapsing on itself, and all of space has everything coming together around it. If you think, you know, sort of you're thinking back in time. So there's no point that was the center in this, except in the sense that every point was the center. So the Big Bang happened everywhere at the same time. Okay. which again, it's really hard to visualize. I think the usual visualization is like, let's say you have a balloon and you start with the balloon sort of crumpled up in your hand with no air in it, and then you inflate it. And each point on that balloon is getting a little bit farther from every other point of that balloon as time goes on. And so each point says, you know, I was once the center and everything is now moving away from me. And you know, in that sense it was, so you're using kind of a higher dimensional.
So this is again, kind of thinking about two dimensions and adding that third. And, and so I think the reason that this gets people tripped up a lot is when we think about, well, if we weren't moving away from any single point, because all points existed in that single point before the Big Bang, or at the moment of the Big Bang, however you want to word it. That becomes the quintessential question, I think, for a lot of people when it comes to cosmology. It's the question that we all asked when I took astrophysics as a freshman in college, which was, but what was on the outside of it? You know what I mean? If everything was in that one point, right outside that point, what was? Or you could then kind of convert that into the same question, which is, what's past the edge of the universe?
Yeah, see, this is a funny thing. When we talk about things like special relativity, general relativity, anytime there's the concept of space-time, we're putting the whole concept of distance, of inside and outside, of edges, of before and after, into this fabric, this sort of physical object, which is space-time. And, you know, if that physical object is small, that's it. There's no distance outside of that. There's no outside of that, outside of that. There's, you know what I mean? Like, you can't, like, the universe in that definition is everything, and there's literally no like definition for stuff beyond, because there is no beyond, because, you know, that's as far as you can go in any direction. And so you can't go in some direction a little bit farther than that, because it's like everything contained.
Because that is it. It's kind of the way that I think about this is going to turn, like, make a really morbid turn really fast. It, when I think about death, for example, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in an afterlife. And I don't believe in anything supernatural. I only believe that there is the natural kind of universe.
Yeah.
And anything above or beyond that is, you know, maybe not even non-existent, but it's not something we can measure. So to me, there's kind of no point. And so when I think of death, I think of this moment in which there's no more existence for me cognitively. It's just off. And so, you know, people talk about, I'm afraid of what happens next, or I'm afraid of dying because of that moment after death. And it's like, but there, but you won't care anymore because you're not alive anymore. And it's just done. It's just nothing. And I think that that concept is so unsettling to a lot of people. And there's sort of, for me, a parallel between that and the idea of, like, outside of that singularity or beyond the edges of the universe is non-existence.
Sure. I mean, actually, you bring up a really good, a good point there, which is that from a scientific point of view, unobservable is literally, like, unimportant. Like, if it's in principle unobservable, and if the in principle has no connection to anything that we can observe or touch or even, you know, connect to our universe at all, it doesn't matter. Like, it really doesn't matter. And so if even if space-time were not kind of the, you know, the everything, if there was some another universe that was out there that was disconnected from our space time, it wouldn't matter, because the edge of ours, you know, I mean, the extent of our space time is the extent of what we have any possibility of interacting with, what, you know, what we have any possibility of having a connection with. And so, you know, even if there were a before the Big Bang, we could not see it. And this is a thing about the Big Bang singularity that comes up a lot. If there was a Big Bang singularity, and when we talk about the Big Bang as, you know, theoretical physicists, we're usually just talking about, like, the idea that the universe was hotter and smaller and denser in the past. We're not really going all the way to the singularity.
Yeah.
But if you do talk about the singularity, if it really was a true singularity, then it is completely unobservable, whatever was, you know, wherever that singularity came from or whatever, because that's everything in a single point, and that's you know, a point of, like, no information can go through a singularity in that way. It's a full, true singularity. Then, you know, whatever could have been behind it, there would be no trace.
And this is kind of like when, for example, like traces, like we're talking about the cosmic microwave background radiation, which we'll get to a little bit. There are all these, like, signatures. There are ways that we can observe things, even if it doesn't mean looking at it with our eyes or touching it with our hands. We can observe fluctuations in other things and trails and shadows of things. And that tells us that there is something physically manifesting, even if it was so long ago we can't see it, or even if it's not within the visible spectrum or whatever. And that's, I think, what obviously astrophysics has been so amazing, especially in recent years, is finding whole facets of the solar, or not the solar system, of the universe as a whole, whole facets that we didn't know existed before because we didn't have the tools to measure them. But beyond that, I think that that kind of reminds me of a conversation I had on my last podcast with Sean Carroll, and we talked a little bit about multiverse theory and this idea of maybe there was another universe before the Big Bang and it's expands and contracts, and or maybe beyond our universe, there's another universe, and there's the salt bubble theories, and maybe sometimes our universes might interact and we would see some sort of signature of that. But if we never did, we would seriously, like, never know that it existed because there's no way to measure. Yeah. And I think this is where sometimes as a science communicator, I get annoyed a little bit with the verbiage, because I'm like, how is that a theory? If there's no evidence to back it up, isn't that just a hypothesis? Because that's something where, you know, kind of anti-science crusaders who like to throw around evolution is just a theory. And then people on the other side of that work so hard to say, no, a theory is something that's based on all sorts of observations. And then we put all these experiments together, we have all this great evidence, and ultimately when enough people agree and there's enough fields that find the same evidence, then it's a theory. But until then, it's just a hypothesis. How is the multiverse theory not a hypothesis?
Well, I think that most of these multiverse ideas, and there are a couple of different ideas where the multiverse comes in, most of those are basically, you take the logical extension of a process that you know could create our universe, and then it would have to create other universes too. And so if you think that you know how our universe came into being, or how it came to be the way it is, and you know that something that would do that multiple times, then that could create multiverse, that would be a multiverse theory that's not technically, we can't technically observe those other universes, but the, you know, this best sort of physical, you know, consistent hypothesis we have for how our universe came into being would kind of necessarily make others.
I love it. It's almost like there's some sort of tenet in physics that says, like, we are not that fucking special.
Exactly. That's a very important tenet. That's the Copernican principle. That's exactly how it's, I mean, it's not usually stated in exactly those terms, but that's how it should be stated because that's what it means.
And that's something that I think the Cosmos theory, the Cosmos series, I'm sorry, both the original Cosmos series, which I think we all really loved, and this new sort of homage to the original Cosmos series. I think one thing that was so important to Carl Sagan that Neil deGrasse Tyson is really carrying on is making sure that we really reinforce that over and over, that we're not that special in the grand scheme of things, but the fact that we have the powers of perception to allow us to understand the grand scheme of things, even to the extent that we do, is so fucking special. Yeah. And it's humbling and it's spiritual and it's, you know, awe-inspiring. And that's, I think, ultimately, for me, the purpose of that. I got a tattoo on my ribs. I've mentioned it before. I got a quote from Carl Sagan that was mentioned in the very first episode of the reboot that just says, "We are a way for the cosmos to know itself." Yeah. And for me, that really encompasses that, kind of that full circle, that we ourselves are made of the same stuff as the stars, and we have these powers of perception. And for me, what it is, it's like a spiritual way to be a total fucking atheist. It's like, it's like, I don't believe in anything beyond, but because I have these powers of perception, which are so special, not saying they're special in that there aren't other beings or there couldn't be other beings that have them, but they're so special in that, you know, even if you just compare the human species to every other species on the planet that ever existed, the fact that we can contemplate things at that level, that we evolved to a point where we could contemplate things at that level, and we can think about our place in the cosmos. The stars can't think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't have that.
Yeah.
And that taking those physical principles and those chemical principles and those biological principles and even the more advanced psychological, anthropological, kind of building science, building on science, is such a really cool place that we are in the universe. And we're very lucky to be able to sit back and actually realize that place that we're in.
Yeah, definitely. I'd made a sort of similar point at a talk I gave at a church once, where it was like, it was one of these things where they have, you know, guest speakers come in and for an after service kind of like education time. And I was talking about our place in the universe, and I was talking about, you know, the expansion of the universe and how we learned that, you know, the other planets didn't orbit around us. And then we learned that, you know, the galaxy didn't orbit around us. And then, you know, we go on and we learn that there's no special point in the universe. And we learn that most of the universe is dark matter and dark energy, and we don't even know what that is. And, you know, we're this little tiny piece of this little tiny fraction of the universe. And, you know, and in some ways, you know, that means that we're so insignificant, but it's also just, it makes our achievements so, so much more impressive that we can understand these things and we can look out at this incredible cosmos that's so much deeper than we initially thought. You know, we thought that like we were the most important, the most interesting thing in it. Now we're like, you know, there's so much more out there. There's so much more to it.
And it's, we're just making incredible discoveries every day. And speaking of making discoveries, I want to talk to you a little bit. Yeah, we got lots of time. I want to talk to you first, actually, before we talk about that, I want to talk about what you do, because, oh my God, you're here and you're all the way here from Melbourne, and this is awesome. And so you are a postdoc at Melbourne University, which means that you have finished your PhD.
Yep.
You did all of the research necessary to do that. You wrote your dissertation. You passed.
Yep.
And how long have you been a postdoc?
So I've been a postdoc for about, 5 years now, almost 5 years. So I did a First, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at Cambridge University for 3 years, and then I moved to Melbourne University a little over a year and a half ago.
And are you doing similar research to what you were doing at Cambridge? At this point, you're really building on a kind of a singular career path.
Yeah.
And so what, aspect of cosmology are you focused on?
So my main focus right now is on dark matter. So dark matter is this kind of invisible stuff that's out there that's most of the matter in the universe. Like 85% of the matter of the universe is something that's completely invisible as far as we can tell. We don't see any light from it. It doesn't absorb light. It doesn't do electromagnetism at all, so it doesn't collide when it can pass through things like a sort of ghostly thing. But it's got gravity, and so it moves things around in the universe. It keeps galaxies together, so stars and galaxies are orbiting faster than they should be if the dark matter wasn't there. And the dark matter is like this extra glue that keeps the galaxy together. And so we
know that to be the case because if there were no dark matter, the math would be off.
Yeah. So basically we look at the orbits of stars far out in the edges of galaxies. And we see that if there were no extra matter there, then the speed at which they're moving is so fast, they should just fly off and the galaxy should just fly apart. And so we see that the galaxies don't do that. And there must be something more holding them in. So there's that evidence for dark matter, and then there's evidence from how it bends light around itself. So like it bends space-time, and then light moves around that, and this thing called gravitational lensing. So we see evidence from that, and we see evidence from the way that galaxies and clusters of galaxies built up over time. And there's all these different ways of finding dark matter, all just by looking at how it affects things that have light, how it affects stars and how it affects light itself and
so,
through its gravity.
You know, if you're kind of an untrained ear and you're listening to this like myself, you might think, well, how then is dark matter, for example, different than a black hole? Because it seems like a black hole also does all those things. It bends space-time. Mm-hmm. It keeps galaxies together. It keeps things pulling in gravitationally. Yeah. It keeps them from flying off into space. A lot of those same components. Sure. And they're also dark. They're kind of undetectable. You can't see them, but you can see things sort of orbiting them.
Yeah.
So how are those things different, for example? Or how do you know that there is this other thing, which is dark matter, on top of just a bunch of black holes, for example?
Well, one of the theories of what dark matter is, it's less favored now, but in the past, the idea was, well, maybe it's just a whole bunch of black holes that are orbiting around in the galaxy in sort of different kinds of orbits. And then, you know, you have this sort of cloud of black holes in all the galaxies, and that keeps everything together. There are a couple of reasons we don't think it's that, or at least not large black holes. Mm-hmm. One of them is that black holes tend to suck in regular matter, and they make these disks around them. And so you'd see radiation from the accretion disks as things are falling in. Another is that when we look at gravitational lensing, we would see kind of little sort of spikes in the lensing signal from individual small black holes, and we don't see that. So it's almost
more consistent than a black hole?
Yeah, it's like more diffuse. So we think that probably dark matter is a sort of diffuse collection of particles, so like a sort of cloud of particles instead of individual compact objects, which black holes would be. But there's still like a mass range. If you had really tiny black holes, like a mass of a mountain or something like that, you could make all of dark matter with those kinds of black holes, and we wouldn't see a difference in terms of the observation. It's just theoretically, it's kind of hard to make lots of black holes that way, because usually we make black holes by having stars collapse and die, and they wouldn't be that small, so they'd have to be at least the mass of a star, which is always bigger. So you'd have to make these black holes in the early universe in a way that's kind of difficult to do. But some people still work on theories of that.
And what about after a black hole, for example? I'm like going down a rabbit hole now. About after a black hole has kind of eaten up everything in its path? It's kind of pulled in everything that was close enough to get caught into its sort of gravitational mouth. And do black holes ever go dormant? Do they burn out? Do they just create almost like an empty spot in space and then kind of shut off?
Well, it's interesting, actually. We know there are black holes in the centers of most galaxies. Mm-hmm. There's one in the center of our galaxy, about a million solar masses or something. And we think that black holes in the centers of galaxies go through periods of dormancy where basically they accrete everything that's nearby them, and then there's like a gap where they're waiting for more stuff to build up, and then they eat some more. Like our black hole has been pretty dormant, hasn't been eating very much, but there's a cloud of gas called G2, I think, that's about to fall into it. And we're all watching carefully. There's going to be like X-ray flares from this cloud of gas falling into the black hole. But usually nothing really falls into the black hole in the center of our galaxy because there's nothing like nearby. So it makes a sort of empty space, and then it comes up again. So there's this sort of cycle of on and off for black holes, we think, for the most part, in like large ones. For the little ones, if you have like some black holes are in binary orbits with other stars. So like one of the stars collapses and forms a black hole, and then the other star is still alive, still burning. And then the black hole that collapsed is like eating the layers of its neighbor. I think there was a sort of image of that in this there Cosmos was. Episode.
And I'm always remembering kind of an image from my old astronomy tech. It's like the prettiest picture of it spiraling off this kind of matter, spiraling off the star and getting sucked down into a black hole.
Yeah, so for black holes like that, they have kind of a continuous food source. If you don't have any matter really nearby the black hole, it can't suck things in from way far away because if you're orbiting a black hole from far enough away, you don't notice anything different than if you were orbiting a star or a planet. It's just some mass. It's only when you get close to the black hole that things get weird. Otherwise, it just acts like anything else.
And so if they had kind of eaten up everything that was close enough, that still couldn't account for the kind of dark matter that you're looking for?
Not if they're massive enough. If they're really low mass, then
it could. That's the difference between that threshold. Sorry, I'm looking at my SoundCloud right now to see if I can find... Somebody had actually asked a question.
Okay.
I was just reminded of it. Somebody had asked a question about my episode last week with Sean Carroll, and it was about dark matter. Yeah. And so I was wondering if it was kind of easy to find on here. Going back to Bitcoin... No, we're going back to episode one here. All right. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to find it, unfortunately. This is about Sean Carroll. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, don't play it. I just want to read that question. Thanks for the awesome episode. I did have one question. Sean mentioned that the Higgs field permeates the whole universe and interacts with everything. What about dark matter? If yes, A, does it interact differently with different particles? And B, maybe we can understand something about dark matter just by looking at how it interacts with the Higgs field, or at least C, have direct evidence of dark matter just from its interactions with the Higgs field. I apologize if this is complete gibberish. I'm a philosopher by training. Physics is just my secret love.
Okay.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about the discovery of the Higgs boson, and Sean talked about how the Higgs field, we have to really understand it as it's not so much about the boson itself, but the whole field, and it's everywhere in space. And so is there anything, I mean, is this how you study dark matter, for example? Do you study how it interacts with, like, gravitational fields, for example, different forces that you know exist and how it sort of pushes or pulls on those or affects those things?
Well, the way that we study dark matter observationally is how it interacts with things that we can actually see. So we study it observationally by how it moves stars around, how it shapes galaxies, how it bends space-time. So like how its gravitational effect bends space-time in a way that makes light curve around it. So light changes its course when it's near a very strong gravitational field. I mentioned curved space-time. Mm-hmm. You have parallel lines that would come together. And so if you have, you can think about it in this sort of funnel analogy again. If you have something trying to move past a curved funnel, then it'll sort of curve around, and that happens with light going past black holes or past anything that's massive, the sun or dark matter. And so we usually see where dark matter is just by looking at the light things, the tracers, the stars and the gas and the galaxies, and see how they're affected by the gravity of the dark matter, how the dark matter first shapes space-time, and then everything else moves around in this curved space-time created by the effect of dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of interaction with the Higgs field, I mean, basically anything that has mass interacts with the Higgs field.
Because that's how we know that things, that's how things get mass.
Yeah. I mean, there's some subtleties to exactly which particles get mass through that mechanism, but anything that's massive in principle has an interaction. And, but we don't, like, it's really hard to measure anything to do with the Higgs field, but it's pretty easy to measure the curvature of space-time just by seeing how things move and how light bends. And so what we usually see, look for is just the gravitational effect through that space-time curvature. So that's the main thing. It's a funny thing about dark matter. You know, so the thing that I study about dark matter is mainly how the particle physics of dark matter affects the evolution of astrophysical objects. So how dark matter particle physics could have effects on the first stars and galaxies and stuff like that.
And do we even know what the particles are in dark matter?
No.
So this is really theoretical.
Yeah, it's pretty theoretical. So we have some theories about what kind of particles dark matter might be made of. We think it's probably made of some kind of new fundamental particle. But all of the evidence we have for dark matter comes from astrophysics. It's all from looking at how dark matter affects things we see in the cosmos with like telescopes and stuff. And even though we think it's a new particle, we've seen no evidence for it in particle experiments. There are these dark matter detectors, and some of them have seen kind of hints, and those are all really ambiguous. We're not really sure what they mean because half of them disagree with others, you know, and so we haven't seen a really clear picture from the particle detectors, but we have incredible evidence from astrophysics that dark matter is real. We know exactly how much of it there is. We know, you know, how we have limits on how much it can interact with light and how much it can interact with itself in terms of, like, if two clumps of dark matter collide, do they pass right through? And it looks like they do, and they don't, you know, collide with
each other.
So it's
almost like these, I mean, like just giant holes in space.
Well, it's kind of like something's, like, if you're walking through the snow and you see footprints, you know, it's like something invisible is making these footprints, you know, so it's shaping space-time. It's shaping space.
But you just can't find the shaper.
Yeah, yeah. So we haven't yet been able to detect the thing that's bending space-time. We've just seen all this bending of space-time around.
Amazing.
I really hope nobody
thinks that dark matter is God. It's like a whole thing that I bet you've dealt with. Well, or if not, you will soon. That's like a whole other philosophical conversation. So, I mean, that's fascinating. What have been some sort of new findings? Have there been any new findings in the field of dark matter? Is it one of those more kind of work your ass off every day, looking at the math, looking at the kind of telescopic, I don't know, evidence? Yeah, sorry. Sometimes we're sitting on the floor, so we're kind of like moving around. It's been a long day. You can move around if you need to. Have there been any kind of hints or tricks or anything new that you guys have learned recently? That no smoking gun yet, obviously.
Right. Yeah. So there's been tons of little hints or little like weird little detections that we don't know what to do with. So there are two different ways that we're usually, there's three ways basically to try to figure out what dark matter is. There's direct detection, which is where you have a detector, you put it deep underground and you wait for a particle of dark matter to bump into something in your detector. And you try and shield it enough that nothing else could get through except dark matter. And so if you see something get bumped, you think it's dark matter, and then you write that down. So there's the direct detectors, and then there's indirect detection, where you look for dark matter doing something weird in the cosmos. Basically, we think that dark matter might be the kind of particle where if two dark matter particles collide with each other, they annihilate and they create some radiation of some kind. And so if that's the case, then you can look for that radiation in space. And so that's called indirect detection, and people use gamma ray telescopes and cosmic ray telescopes to look for that.
And have people found any of that? Like, well, weird radiation that they can't account for?
This is the thing, yeah. There's a whole bunch of detections of weird radiation they can't account for, but at the same time, like, space is complicated.
Yeah, like it could be anything.
Out there. Yeah, there's tons of stuff out there. There's pulsars, there's magnetic fields doing weird things. There's, like, some of the biggest hints lately have come from the center of the galaxy. And there's tons of stuff in the center of the galaxy. There's a whole bunch of stars. There's a whole bunch of gas and dust. There's a massive black hole mm-hmm. that occasionally eats things. There's lots of pulsars. There's like these bubbles of gas that have been blown out by some kind of process earlier in the universe. There's wow. a disk of stars and gas and dust. So like there's tons of stuff going on in the center of the galaxy. And so, you know, every once in a while we see like some gamma rays from there that we can't quite account for, or some kind of, you know, we see cosmic ray signals from nearby that we don't really know what those are. And, you know, and there's always somebody writes a paper saying, wait, maybe this is dark matter. And then there's people, then a bunch of theorists like me. I haven't done this myself, but people who do dark matter theory, write these papers saying, you know, here's the kind of dark matter particle theory that could work to explain this anomaly. Mm. And so far, nothing has been like really, really solid where we're really sure that it is dark matter. It's always been like, well, it might be dark matter. It might be some kind of astrophysics we just didn't understand before.
Sure.
So that's indirect detection. That's a big, you know, it's a really active field, and there's tons of things being discovered all the time. But we just don't know if they're, you know, we don't know for sure what they are yet. And
yeah.
I think what you really need to do with that is you need to find two different signals in like different kinds of detectors that are consistent with each other.
Sure, like, they kind of correspond.
Yeah, yeah. And that hasn't really been done yet. So that's indirect detection. And with direct detection, as I mentioned before, there are a whole bunch of different experiments, and like three or four of them have seen signals, and all the others have seen no signals in the same kind of, for the same kind of particle and the same kind of interaction. And so like there are these limits that are completely ruling out the signals that have been seen. And so nobody really knows what to do with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the third way to look for dark matter is with colliders. So as I said, it might be true that two dark matter particles, if they collide really carefully enough, then they can annihilate into like radiation or other kinds of particles. If you try and sort of do that reaction backward, then if you collide two pieces of regular matter, you might be able to get two dark matter particles out the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what something like the Large Hadron Collider is trying to do. So, the LHC is doing a number of things, but one of the things that they're looking for is signatures of dark matter, of creating dark matter in their collider.
Yeah.
And what they would see is they would do a collision, then they would count up all the sort of debris from that collision, and they would see something missing. And that would be like the dark matter particles escaping and flying out without interacting with anything.
Have any leads come out of CERN at all?
Nope.
Not yet.
Nope. No limit. We've only got limits. We have seen no evidence for dark matter creation in CERN. And we've also seen no evidence for one of the biggest, the leading theory of where dark matter might come from, which is supersymmetry theory, which is this kind of extension of our usual model of particle physics. We've seen no evidence of that either. And that's wow. where we had one of our most sort of theoretically compelling dark matter candidates. So there's still models of supersymmetry that kind of work, but we've ruled out a lot of them. And so theoretically, dark matter particles coming from that are looking kind of weird as well. So it's a really active and confusing field right now.
Well, it sounds like an exciting field to be in because I think a lot of people who are in the sciences because they want to be on the verge of new discovery.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have these kind of cynics that say, oh, what else can we learn? What else can we learn today?
Right.
We know so much. It's like there's so many things we don't understand.
Yeah.
And it seems like you are basically studying one of the most elusive things you could possibly try to study.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, dark matter is a great place to be right now because I really think in the next couple of years, we're going to have much more solid evidence. Like, we're going to really figure out what this thing is. And right now, it's just really confusing and really fun. You know, it's always fun when you don't understand it and you have this puzzle, right? And right now we have this puzzle where there are all these little pieces and we don't know which ones fit together or what the big picture is going to look like. But there's certainly plenty to work on and plenty of things to get confused by and try and figure out.
And of course, as we all know in science, what we love sometimes is how every single answer just raises more questions.
Oh yeah.
I think speaking of kind of this hope, right, that in the next few years, you're going to have some sort of big chunk of evidence that really fills in some gaps that you can start working around.
Yeah.
That's something that seems to have happened recently in the sector of cosmology that concerns itself with inflation.
Yeah.
So last week I aired the episode that I did with Sean Carroll, but we had actually recorded it a week previously, and okay. Sean hinted to the fact that this Monday there's going to be a big announcement, and of course that ended up being a week prior. I had to do a little disclaimer at the top of the episode, like, we didn't time travel, we just recorded this a week ago. And so, unfortunately, we didn't really have a chance to talk about it because it still hadn't gone public. And of course, he didn't want to break any embargoes if he did have any kind of privileged information. But from what some people may have gathered, there was a discovery coming off of this BICEP 2 kind of investigation. And this discovery was some sort of signature. Correct me if I'm wrong as I'm going in. I'm going to give the super layman's explanation.
Okay.
And then you tell me why I completely butchered it. Some sort of signature was found in the cosmic microwave background radiation mm-hmm. of early. We're talking fractions of a second after the Big Bang, gravitational waves.
Yes.
And so what does that mean?
Okay. Just to give a little bit of background, BICEP 2 is a telescope in the South Pole, and it looks at the cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background is the sort of afterglow of the Big Bang. And as you look out in every direction, you see, you know, into the distant past, and in every direction you see this background light, and it's the CM. It's called the CMB, the cosmic microwave background. And that's like the last light of the primordial fireball before things started to cool down and become, you know, sort of regular cold matter that could form into stars and galaxies and things.
And so this is something where, and correct me if I'm wrong, again, I'm going to say that a lot.
Okay.
Actually, those of you who are listening right now who are a fan of the Old Talk Nerdy to Me episodes that I did with HuffPost, I actually did a whole piece about the cosmic microwave background where I interviewed John Mather, who won a Nobel Prize in this kind of field. And he really explained a lot of this. So you can kind of go back to that for a little additional reference too, because there's a lot of pretty visuals in it that he offered us. But after the Big Bang, there was a period of time where everything was really hot and everything was very opaque.
Yeah.
And then eventually things started clumping together and there was enough kind of distance in between things that you could start seeing through space. And that sort of period of time where everything was hot and opaque, we don't have a very good signature of. It's very hard to know what was happening in those first, what was that,
It was 380,000 years.
380,000 years of kind of like, I don't know what was going on. And then after that, we start to see all these beautiful signatures, right of things that were going on, because we can look in far reaches of the universe and we can see things that actually must have been that old. Otherwise, they still wouldn't be sending light to us.
Yes. Yeah.
So the cosmic microwave background radiation is actually the radiation that would have been released during the Big Bang?
No, so the cosmic microwave background is the radiation that that the first radiation to escape that sort of fireball time. So I say fireball, it's not a ball, but like
so
the whole universe.
So that was the hot, opaquey thing that
I was
talking about.
Yeah, that's the hot, opaque
thing. I see, okay. Yeah. So that 380,000 years after the Big Bang, everything was sort of soupy hot, stuck together, hard to see through.
Yeah.
Right after that, we start to see signatures, and that's because, the cosmic microwave radiation.
Yeah, that's when light can travel freely, and specifically like that energy scale of light, that wavelength of light can travel freely and not bump into atoms and get scattered around. It can travel straight through the universe. And so when we look back far enough, we're looking at the bit of the universe that's still in that fireball and just cooling down enough that the light can start traveling to us, and we see that light, like the edge of that fireball, sort of in time, not in space.
Sure. Okay. And so when we talk about what was discovered, this is what's interesting to me, is I had always kind of thought about it that way, thought about what this idea of the CMB, this idea of all of the, and we're talking like the fuzz on your TV. Mm-hmm. We're talking, those are signatures from the Big Bang. We're talking radiation that exists all around us that literally has been there since just on the cusp of that 380,000 years after the Big Bang, which is a really long time ago when we know that the universe itself is 13.7 billion years old, right? So when I heard about this BICEP 2 finding, this is fractions of a single second after the Big Bang. So how is it that we made that jump all the way back from 380,000 years after to a fraction of a second after?
Yeah, yeah. So it's really cool, actually. So basically, with the cosmic microwave background, we see patterns in that light, and we see patterns in the polarization of that light, and in the very, very early universe, in the first like tiny, tiny fractions of a second, 10 to the minus 35 or something, we think the universe was undergoing this really, really rapid expansion called inflation. And in the process of that expansion, or when it was stopping, we think it created gravitational radiation, so sort of ripples in space-time. And those ripples like traveled through this sort of cosmic soupy fireball time and affected the patterns we see on the sort of edge of that fireball, the patterns in the cosmic microwave background polarization. So the polarization is like the sort of direction of the light. And if you have like polarized glasses that blocks some direction of light and not others, and when you go to a 3D movie, each eye has a different polarization of light, so that's why it can like put together a picture. So the Bicep 2 telescope looks at polarizations in the cosmic microwave background, and it can see patterns in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, and it sees a pattern that we think could only be created by gravitational waves, by ripples in space-time during that cosmic soup kind of fireball time. And so we think that those ripples could only have come from this inflation period, and that inflation period ended about 10 to the minus 35 seconds. So a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, something like that.
So it was kind of this shockwave right at the beginning that then sent these concentric ripples out. And knowing, let's say that I'm a scientist who wants to understand what happened in the middle of a lake, but for some reason I'm allergic to water and I can't get in that water to measure it. So I can only study what's happening right on the shore.
Sure.
So there's this lake and I know none of my tools can measure what's in that water. Unfortunately, the water is just poisonous to me, but I can see what's happening right at that shore. And if there was this huge shockwave, this huge ripple, this inflation right at the beginning, ultimately that little wiggle is going to make it all the way to the shore.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, except that you have to say that like you have ripples in all parts of the lake. And so it's not really the middle.
But it's a
great analogy because it's the very same kind of process. You have these sort of ripples being created all over space-time, so in the whole lake. So let's say you drop a whole bunch of rocks at once, and then you're sitting at the edge and you see all these sort of ripples coming together. And that's what we see. We see this like background, this sort of random background of fluctuations that put this pattern into this polarization. And we think that, I mean, I don't know of any other way to make that pattern of fluctuations. So it's really exciting because so I think there are two reasons that it's really, really exciting. One is that it's evidence for inflation. So we think that the universe did this inflation thing for a couple of different reasons. And they're pretty compelling reasons, but there might be other mechanisms to do that. So one of them is to solve a problem where we see that the universe is too uniform, like the cosmic microwave background in one direction is the same temperature as the cosmic microwave background in a totally opposite direction. And those two parts of the sky were like never really in the same place. And so they couldn't have found the same temperature unless there was some kind of really rapid expansion in the very beginning that took a part of the universe that was all close together and so could have been in the same temperature and then expanded it out to be as big as the whole observable universe we see today.
Yeah.
So that's one problem that inflation seems to solve. And there are a couple of other things. And there have been other theories that could do that, could have the same sort of purpose as inflation in terms of like trying to solve a problem theoretically. But some of those other solutions wouldn't make these gravitational waves. Mm. But inflation does. And so it seems to be really, really good evidence for inflation being a thing that actually happened in the universe.
And so if these gravitational waves, for example, can be found again, and if nobody else can come up with a valid explanation for these gravitational waves. Yeah. It seems most likely that this is semi-direct evidence of inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's one of those, that's why you kind of hear people hedging their words when you listen to scientists talk about, if it pans out, this is amazing.
Yeah, because it's a preliminary result, basically. I mean, it's from the point of view of the collaboration that found it, it's not preliminary, it's their final result. Yeah. But
it's the first result.
Yes, it's the first result. And so, you know, in cosmology and particle physics, you always learn not to really trust that first result so much. You want to get other experiments or other observations to test the same thing and find the same answer. So there are a whole bunch of other experiments that are going to look for this, and they're going to hopefully find the same answer or find a similar answer and prove that stuff is really there.
So there was a researcher, I remember seeing the video passed around on YouTube. There's a researcher named kind of the father of inflationary theory. Yeah. And there's this video passed around of one of the researchers on the BICEP experiment, on the BICEP 2 experiment, going to his house to inform them of their findings. And I mean, it like brings tears to your eyes to see him and his wife. What's the researcher's name? Do you remember?
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Yeah, so the person in that video is André Linde.
Okay.
And he's not the first person who invented inflation theory. He's one of the people who developed it after it was first proposed by another researcher called Alan Guth.
I see.
So in the video is André Linde, who worked on inflation theory early on, and his wife Renata Kalisch, who is also a theoretical physicist. And then the BICEP 2 guy came to their house and told them that they found this finding. And the reason that André Linde gets so excited about this is, and his wife also, because it seems to be just really, really consistent with André Linde's theories and with this whole idea of inflation. But I really kind of took issue with that video calling Linde the father of inflation.
Yeah, because somebody like myself who hasn't studied this, you know, this is what I see and this is what I think. And I did see people mentioning Guth. I saw that name on online from some of my friends and colleagues who work in cosmology mentioning him, and kind of, you know, from an outside perspective, it's something that I think we see a lot, unfortunately, in the sciences, where one person gets a certain type of publicity or one person's name gets on a certain type of paper, or for whatever reason, credit doesn't always end up where credit's due, or not that it doesn't end up where it's due, but it's not spread out the way that maybe it should be.
I mean, I think if you're going to credit one person with inflation, you'd probably have to choose Guth, because he was sort of the first person to write down, you know, this is a sort of process that could happen that could solve these problems. If you're going to credit more than one person, sure, Linde should be in there. Lots of people should be in there who were involved with first putting together a working model of inflation, because Alan Guth's original theory was not formulated quite correctly. It couldn't quite work.
I see.
So Linde,
and so the
was
reason with
people.
Linde, this kind of video was so sort of emotional and compelling, is because this evidence really supported his kind of model.
Yeah.
So he was like, well, I think it could work like this based on the math. And then they're like, oh my God, we might have found a signature of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a model that also Guth now works on, but it, you know.
So why didn't anybody go to Guth's house, damn it? I don't know. Video might exist somewhere. Let's dig it up.
It might.
All right, so we are actually running low on time. It's almost time to wrap it up, but I did want to end this episode of Talk Nerdy the same way I've been ending all of my episodes of Talk Nerdy, which is to ask you, Katie, two questions that I've been asking everybody. Okay. I don't know if I'm going to compile them at some point. I may do something with it, but I think it's really cool to get different people from different backgrounds, perspectives on these two very basic questions. One being, if you think about the future, what is the thing that kind of concerns you the most looking forward into the future? And the other is, what is the thing that you're most excited about looking forward into the future in whatever context?
Okay.
You are, because it's so interesting to see how scientists say things different than kind of political figures, and everyone's got their own answer.
I think the thing that concerns me the most about the future at the moment is climate change. I think that's something that's clearly a disaster that's coming to us, and we're clearly not doing enough about it. And, you know, it's kind of scary to think how the world is going to change, and how sort of political systems are going to change when there's, you know, climate refugees and stuff like that. And so, I mean, that's the thing that I think I worry about most in terms of, you know, what's going to happen in the future. Yeah. I think that, you know, we're a very, we're a species with a lot of ingenuity, and I hope we find a good solution. But at the moment, it seems like we're kind of dragging our feet on that. And so that worries me a lot.
I'd say, to put it mildly, we're dragging our feet, for sure. Yeah.
The thing that most excites me, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, I guess I'm biased. I'm excited by scientific discovery. You know, I'm excited by all the things that we're learning about the universe, about the human mind. There's so much really amazing stuff going on in terms of like research about how the brain works and how people work in terms of like social, you know, how we work as a social species and how we interact with each other. That's really exciting. How medicine works, you know, learning about diseases and, you know, trying to figure out how not to, you know, kill everybody with a super virus that we can't deal with.
Yeah, it's another one of those concerned
categories. Yeah, that would be another thing I would put in the concern category. And just, you know, exploring the solar system, exploring the cosmos.
And finding that dark matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Finding out what's in that dark
matter. And finding new planets, you know, finding planets that in solar systems other than our own, and hopefully finding life on some of those. And
so many good candidates.
I know, it's getting really exciting.
It's getting to the point where every day it's like, you're so right, we are not that special. And the minute that we figure out how to actually find life, or mm-hmm. what life would look like, or how to recognize it, or some sort of new detection. And we're every day. I mean, there's just recently a discovery about how to detect these sort of exoplanets a little bit better. So we're getting so close. And God, can you imagine if in our lifetimes we found extraterrestrial life?
I think we will. Cause we're getting to the point where we're examining the atmospheres of planets around other suns, you know, and we can examine the chemical composition of these atmospheres, and we know what to look for life like our own. We know what kind of chemical signatures to look for. And there's so many candidates now for planets in the habitable zones of their stars. I think it's just a matter of time. I think it's a matter of, you know, building slightly more powerful telescopes and analyzing the data, but I think we'll see it.
So cool.
Yeah.
So excited. All right. Well, Katie, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, staying up late after our Cosmos party, hanging with me, talking about all this fascinating stuff. Let everybody know how they can get in touch. I know that people can tweet you at AstroKatie. Where else are you hanging out on the interwebs?
I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/AstroKatie. And I have a website, AstroKatie.com. So those are the main places to look for me.
I love it.
Yeah. So I would probably start with Twitter, because that's where I am most of the time.
Me too. I'm definitely on Twitter a lot more than Facebook. Sorry, Facebook people. Yeah. Well, Katie, thank you again. And
that's
everybody,
my pleasure.
I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.